everyone. So I am here this week with Marcia, who I find in Barcelona.
No. I'm in Madrid.
You're in Madrid. Yeah. Oh, see, right then I didn't know. Okay, so you're in Madrid. And it's really good timing. And I reached out to you because I've been in Spain for a few weeks. I'm in Rome right now. And I stumbled across an interview with you. And it was very timely because I've been speaking to a lot of fellow Americans and Canadians that have retired, want to retire, or just want to move. People are moving and working remotely more than ever. And I think there's a lot of curiosity about moving abroad and coming to Europe. And certainly Spain has become such a draw for so many reasons. And both Madrid and Barcelona are really such international cities, especially Barcelona. It was so cosmopolitan.
Well, I think in Madrid even more so, actually.
Really? Yeah. I need to go back. It's been quite a while. But before we get to Spain, let's backpedal a little bit because you have a very fascinating career. And this is always what I love. I meet people for the first time. So from what I heard, I'm not sure if you're from California, but you certainly worked there in film for a while. Could you just tell me a little bit about your background?
Well, I was born in Los Angeles. I was born in the Queen of Angels Hospital right beside the Hollywood Freeway and lived there all my life. And wanted to be in the film business and eventually got into the film business through the assistant director's training program. And I worked as an assistant director, which is not getting coffee for the director. It's a union job, a guild job, doing the logistics and administrative part of film of production on major feature films and primetime television. So I did that for 20 years.
Wow. I was going to say, too, I mean, I have a lot of friends in film, and that is a big job. I mean, especially, I'm not sure when you entered into that field, but I can't imagine there probably wasn't a lot of women in that field.
We were some of the first women, and that was one of the points of the assistant director's training program, because it was a lot of nepotism. It was all men, and they wanted to get women and minorities in. And so it was a kind of an affirmative action program. You had to test in, and very, very competitive. And so, yeah, it was, and I'm just writing the memoir about that now, about the experience.
I can't wait to hear about that.
it was tough. And working in the film business is very tough. The hours are just brutal. And then it's very high stress, very big egos, a lot on the line for everybody. So it's a very intense experience.
Did you grow up around it? I mean, I know you were in Los Angeles.
No, I didn't have
anybody
that
else.
I knew who was in it. And that's another reason they need the assistant director's training program, because you can't get in it without knowing someone.
That's right. Well, and I'm still hoping more women get into it even now.
It's 22. Not much better. And we started affirmative action through the Directors Guild in like the 80s. And the figures have only slightly improved.
Oh, it's pretty sad. I'll have to link some statistics because I came across an article that like shocked me recently around the last Oscars, just talking about women, forget about even being nominated, just like even working in the field.
We were running benchmarks on the number of hours directed, you know, by women and minorities. And I mean, since the 80s, it's improved like maybe 15%. But I mean, it was way, way, way less than the men.
We have a long ways to go, but I'm hoping we need the storytellers. I'm always talking about women are the cultural storytellers. We really need that narrative out there. So after you worked in film for the 20 years, I believe, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm making my little notes from that interview. You had retired and then you moved, correct?
Right. I moved to Santa Fe, New Mexico.
And which I love. Another great city.
And I lived in Santa Fe for 10 years and I worked as a freelance journalist. And I still work as a freelance journalist. And I did, in both Los Angeles and Santa Fe, I sold real estate, and that was sort of a dark period.
Right. What years are we talking about?
We're talking about, the early 2000s. So I got, my idea was I was going to invest in real estate in Santa Fe, and that was going to be my retirement and nest egg, because I spent all the money I made in the movie business traveling.
Sure.
Because
that's a good
business,
too.
the work is really intense. You're working so many hours that you have time for nothing. So you make good money and you can't spend it, and then you're unemployed. And so I would take the money that I had just made and buy a plane ticket and go to Asia. and travel around until the money was almost gone and then go back and get another job. So at the end of 20 years, basically, I had no money. I had
No, but it's interesting. And this is, I think it's a big draw to also to film, because it's a common story I hear from a lot of my friends, 100%, because if you're working a certain amount of jobs, and a lot of times by choice too, so people can take those interim times and either they're working on something on the side, or travel is a huge, huge part of it as well. So clearly you did a lot of world travel. Were you a big solo traveler? Was that your primary thing? I'm a big solo traveler.
I love solo travel. I got divorced in like around 85, 86, and my husband was a terrible traveler, and we did big travel, and he was just always complaining about everything. And so then after I was divorced, and I was like, okay, I'm going by myself, and
that's right.
Great.
It is.
I love it. You can do whatever you want to do, whenever you want to do it. You don't have to negotiate anything. You don't have to listen to any complaints.
No. No. I always tell people I feel the freest when I'm a big solo traveler and I am at my best. You can wander, you make your own plans. You can, you tend to delve into things too really deeply, just because you never know where the day is going to take you.
Well, and you meet people
so fascinating.
Who might take you on some tangent that you wouldn't have been able to go on by yourself. And, it's...
That's right.
And it's not like you're alone for me. So...
No.
I always, when I arrive in a place, I take one of the free walking tours that are like everywhere now.
That's what I do, walking and bike tours.
Yeah, and it's like the free ones, because they only are paid by tip, they try really hard to give you a good tour, to get a good tip.
Yeah,
and so
they really
they're
do.
They're fantastic. And a lot of the people are historians or professors or actors or something, so they're really good tour guides. So I do that, and then you meet someone on that tour that you can have lunch with, A lot of times I'll stay in an Airbnb that where the owner is there, so that then that's a person who's a local who can tell you which bus to take and what's a good restaurant nearby and other things that aren't in the tourist guidebook. So
every time I get the best restaurant recommendations, the best everything from whenever I'm meeting people on those tours that are local, because they really do want to share the best of what they know and for you to see the authentic experience really of their hometown. So I really, really appreciate that. Do you have, this is a hard question, but did you have a favorite trip that you took kind of during those years when you were first exploring?
Well, in those years, I was really, I had traveled a lot all my life. And in those years, I was really into Asia. And so I, did a lot of travel in Asia. And one of the favorites was Bali and Indonesia, and Bali and Jakarta, basically. And that was like 30 years ago now, so I'm sure it's quite different. But...
I wish I'd kind of seen it then. I mean, I loved it. I was there in 2005 and had a remarkable experience, but I feel like so many people have... taken over it because they are also in love with it. So I'm sure it was not nearly as touristy at that time then. It must have been a very special experience.
Yeah, no,
really,
it was really quite wonderful. So...
Yeah, and it's funny going back to Santa Fe because we have very deep family roots in that part of the country. And I always tell people, because Santa Fe is the oldest capital city, pre-America, but it's been there forever. And I think a lot of people haven't explored it, and it's such a fantastic town. And ironically, because you're living in Spain, we'll get to that. I think people forget the deep ties and that was New Spain before.
Santa Fe is really a Spanish town.
It is. Yep. That is, and just outside Los Angeles too, I always say how Santa Barbara always celebrates Spanish days or old Spanish days every year in the summer.
Yeah,
it's a huge event. And so there's all these times.
That western part of the United States was part of Spain and then part of Mexico.
So, that's right. I know how easily people forget.
And actually, New Mexico has been either Spain or Mexico longer than it has been a state.
That's right. Yep. Because I think it only became a state in, 1912.
Continental state in 1914 or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. See? Yeah. Right to the very end. That's fascinating. I think it's fascinating. So you're in Santa Fe, working in real estate or having investments in real estate as well. And then I can see where this is going because we're hurtling towards the financial crash.
Right. So in 2008, in that financial crash, the property that I had went so completely upside down that I was underwater $100,000 on two properties. Yeah. And it just made no sense to try to continue with that. And because I had been getting my income from selling real estate, then I didn't have any income either. And I was absolutely lost everything and went bankrupt and had less than nothing because I had borrowed some money from friends that I had to pay back. Mm. So that was like the absolute crash. And I realized at that point that I had to find a place where I was going to be able to live on my pensions. I had Social Security and a pension from Directors Guild. So,
and I imagine, I'm not sure, I don't worry, I won't go into the specifics, but I think, again, Europeans looking at Americans, I think they have these ideas about like certain pensions and like us getting all this money, which that's really not the case. It's minimal. So unless you have some other income stream, it really becomes very difficult to, where are you going to live in the US anymore? Where is affordable? Where, you know, where are you covering your bills at? And forget about buying something, even renting, especially at that point, would have been extremely difficult. So had you already kind of been looking to Europe, or what?
No, actually, Europe was not on my list at all. And so and I love Santa Fe. I love everything about Santa Fe except the winter. It's really cold.
Yeah.
And so it is. I started then traveling during the winters. I would give up my apartment in the winter in Santa Fe, put things in storage, and then take, you know, that time. And I was traveling in South America, Central America, looking for cheap places. I love Mexico. I've spent a lot of time in Mexico. At one point, I lived in Mexico 6 months at Ajijic.
Oh, wow.
And so that was on the list. I love Guatemala. And so that's where I was traveling. So in the meantime, I had gotten a certificate to teach English as a second language when I was in the process of going bankrupt. Maybe I could do that. And so in the summers, I was teaching that at Santa Fe University of Art and Design in an English immersion program where faculty were coming from affiliated universities. And a lot of them were in South America, from Chile, from Brazil. You know, so I was visiting former students as kind of a motivation, because I'm kind of really looking for community, right? If you're going to move somewhere, you need friends. So
that's,
I had these former students, and I, you know, was enjoying visiting them and seeing where they lived and checking it out for a place for me to live. Well, one of the affiliated universities was Madrid, and I had had students from Spain. And one in particular, we had become friends. He is an art professor, fine arts professor, and a performance artist, new media artist. And then he had come back in the next year as a visiting professor in the art department there. And then we got to know each other really well. And so the winter of 2016, I was like, oh, well, I'll go visit Alberto in Spain. And thinking Spain was going to be too expensive for my pensions, right? But then got to Madrid. Madrid was like, wonderful. It checked a lot of boxes.
Fantastic.
And it was not that expensive. And then Alberto took me to visit his parents in Sevilla. And then I took a bus to Granada. And then I went to Barcelona and, you know, traveled like Cadiz. And, you know, was really traveling around Spain. And another thing I did that I recommend to everybody is in Spain and also in a couple other places in Europe, there are these English immersion programs for Spaniards or Germans or Italians who are trying to learn English. And they need English-speaking volunteers. And so you go to a Spanish resort for free for a week, and you talk to people about 10 hours a day.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
And so I did that. I had heard about that, and I did that. And in that process, I made more friends who were in Madrid. And
that's
Spanish,
right.
People, professional people. These are all professional adults who need English for their work. And so then by the time I was 6 weeks later, I was getting ready to leave Spain. I was like, this is it. This checks all my boxes. And I think I have 10 friends in Madrid. I could move to Madrid. And so then I flew back. I had a 7-hour layover in Dallas. I got the worst food poisoning of my life. in that airport in Dallas. I was so sick on the plane going back to Santa Fe. And I thought, like,
that's a sign.
It's like, don't stay in the U.S. You're going to get sick. Go to Spain. So it took me about a year to figure out the whole immigration thing. And I had just barely enough money to get into Spain on the retirement visa.
Is that the non-lucrative visa?
The non-lucrative visa.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm going to write more about this because I had done an article just on a digital nomad or a remote work visas, because you can get those pretty easily now anywhere in Europe if you just want an extension for a year. But the non-lucrative visa, I have a number of friends on that, both in Spain and Portugal, especially because Portugal is actually like it has a faster track to citizenship. And I think everybody's eyeing
it has
the EU
possibility. Taxes are a little better in Portugal, too.
Yeah. Yeah, there's like so many options. And, you know, again, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but the thing with non-lucrative is you can't be like making money in Spain, but it doesn't mean that you have to have a threshold of money that you're bringing in elsewhere. So that could be through retirement or you could be working remotely.
No, not in America. It can only be through pensions or investments. There's supposed to be a digital nomad visa coming this year for Spain. But on the non-lucrative visa, technically, you cannot be working anywhere in the world.
Interesting. I think there's so many different ones because I think other countries are very much wanting certainly people to move, work, retire, or at least bringing in other money and staying there. Spain for sure is a huge. Spain needs it, but it's so popular with the Brits. But of course, when Brexit happened, that made a big mess of all the real estate investments because a lot of English people have property, especially down south.
A lot of them had to go home. They hadn't been there long
enough. Right.
And now they have to come in on the same terms as the Americans and Canadians coming on the non-lucrative visa. And they're whining.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. They are not happy. It was because I live in London currently, and it was like a huge scene in the newspaper. People are not happy about it. But that's the other thing. Portugal also decided to start treating people differently coming in the country because they wanted the Brits to come in too. So they started waiving, I guess, some of the rules recently, just because they want to treat it like a fast EU entry. So I'm curious to see how that will evolve. But okay, so you decide I'm going to move to Spain. That's it. It was it pretty fast when you came back to Santa Fe, and then you
it took
got
about
the
a year
visa organized
to get all the paperwork together and get approved, and 3 trips to Houston because you have to go to the consulate that's assigned to you on where you live.
Oh, that's interesting. So if they actually assign one to you,
and I guess that was the closest
one. Your
permanent residency, because I would have rather have gone to LA where I have friends to stay with and all that, but I was assigned to Houston because I was in New Mexico. So it was during that year, like at the time I had decided to start trying to get the visa, the presidential campaign was starting and we all thought Trump was
God.
A joke.
Yeah.
And then by the time I had gone to Houston 3 times, I was like, whoa.
Like, I need to get out of here ASAP.
And then, right when I got the visa, it was like when Trump was inaugurated. And I was like, see, I knew. Somehow I knew.
This was the time. Your timing was perfect. So you get the visa, you come in. How did you find real estate, like settling down, finding an apartment, coming in as a
well, so,
expat?
Well, okay,
really?
Some of I didn't have money to buy anything, so I'm renting. I had to rent. So
sure.
Some of those friends I made in the English immersion program were just absolutely wonderful, and I'm not sure I could have done it without them. Because when you go to the immigration office, no one there speaks English. And I spoke at that point a little Spanish, but that's certainly not enough to deal with a bureaucrat.
You know? No.
So Isabel, one of these friends, went with me. You know, she's relatively bilingual. And then to get on the telephone and make appointments to view apartments, terrifying. In Spanish.
Yeah,
so there's a website, it's called idealista.com, and it's all over Spain and Portugal, I think. And, you know, there's all kinds of filters, where you want to be, how many bedrooms you want, you know, all that stuff. So I was looking at that and finding places, and then she was calling and booking appointments, and then she went with me to view the apartments. And then when I found one, another friend went with me to sign the rental contract. Because for anything like that, really, you need someone who really speaks Spanish, any technical things I think.
And to vouch, I guess, or to have like another name or someone local.
Right. And I think that they're a little bit nicer. Well, Spanish people are wonderfully friendly and nice. Spanish yes. civil servants? Not necessarily. And I think if there's a yep. Spanish person with you, they're a little more helpful.
It's true. And it's funny, I'll give a hot tip, some inside scoop for Americans. But I have a number of friends that got visas processed through both Los Angeles and New York. And word on the street is that you actually want to work with a consulate in New York because it was like a better process where a lot of people were running into a lot of trouble because each consulate can sort of ask for something different.
Yeah, they have different requirements. But you can't just go to New York. You have to be living in there.
No. But if people are in New York, you're going to have probably a better experience. But just from what I was hearing, some comparisons, and I was in Barcelona recently, and there was quite a few New Yorkers I know that moved like right before the pandemic or kind of right at the at the beginning of after it started. And then the same with, I just think that there was already kind of a movement with people looking abroad. Certainly the election sped things up. Certainly financial factors sped things up. And I think overall lifestyle factors sped things up. And of course, healthcare. So for you, is it true that when you first arrived there, you can't really be part of like the country healthcare, but you pay for like a private healthcare?
Right, on the non-lucrative visa, you have to have private Spanish healthcare. But still, right. Private Spanish healthcare,
I think much better
probably
than
less than I would be paying for Medicare, Medigap, and a Plan D.
Oh my God.
The healthcare you have to get the visa has to include everything. No right. deductibles, no copay, everything. And the one I have includes all that and basic dental. And it's.
Oh, wow.
And it goes, it increases as you age, of course. So if you're under 65, it's like $150 a month or something.
Oh my God.
I'm 75, so now at this point I'm paying 230 euros a month, which is maybe $260 or $250.
Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah. But I mean, everything, including basic dental, tests, everything, not prescriptions, but prescriptions are so ridiculously cheap that it doesn't matter.
I mean, that's a huge game changer, too. And I think, it's funny because my listeners are primarily like the U.S. and then Canada and the U.K. So Canadian, U.K. listeners, I know this doesn't mean anything to you, but for Americans that pay an insane amount of money for the very basics and prescriptions are like through the roof. It's like, that's a night and day scenario. That's a huge, huge, that's just another added reason to move elsewhere. And certainly the amount of retirees like leaving for, we were saying Central America before, that's happening in droves, South America, and then definitely again like Portugal and Spain. And I keep on running into actually Californians in Spain.
It's quite
running
similar.
To them everywhere.
The weather is quite similar to California.
Yeah, really. I mean, in Barcelona, I mean, I've been to Barcelona a lot, but this last time felt like there was really a switch towards this very cosmopolitan. And I know there's loads of international students, same with Madrid, but it just felt very different. And I felt like these cities are shifting a little bit and people are, it's going to be more and more coveted, I think, as more and more people, everybody's been to Barcelona, but I think when people really spend more time there now, these might be the tipping points where they also start thinking, is there another option for me?
Right,
too?
And the thing with Madrid for me, because what I was looking for in retirement, also, I mean, the Spanish beaches are great, and they're actually less expensive than either Madrid or Barcelona. So if you're wanting a beach or golf vacation, the whole Costa del Sol, Costa Blanca is really wonderful. I wanted more.
I was just there. It was great.
Retirement and Madrid right now, especially in film, because Netflix put their European production headquarters in Madrid.
That's right.
So I think a lot of the people in the film business, the actors, are shifting from Barcelona and other parts of Europe to Madrid. So it's really now got a very creative pulse. Fantastic nightlife, unbelievable nightlife. Great food.
Oh, so I've seen. You're probably having a better nightlife in Madrid than most people are back in America.
By far.
I mean, you can speak to this more, but I mean, it's just the general lifestyle. Certainly, it's a later night, culture anyways, but that it's also... it's, you know, obviously in America, it's like you go for dinner, you might make one more stop, you go home, or you're like going too far, you're just clubbing and then you're going home. Like there's no medium, but it's just part of the lifestyle where everybody's out and talking and having dinner and going for walks.
One of the big selling points for me too is this joie de vivre of the Spanish lifestyle. Yeah. It's like, you know, socializing with your friends and your family is far more important than work. You know, so I mean,
yeah, it really is.
US, we have this work culture. In Spain, it's like, hey, 6 o'clock, I'm having a beer with my friends. You know, or 9 o'clock, we're meeting for tapas and wine, and we're going to talk until midnight at least. That's when the Cuban dance band starts.
And, and the good stuff starts happening. I know. I mean, I just feel, I mean, it was very palpable this time. And I think I've been through so many times before, but I am also at that tipping point where I'm like, it's funny because I have Spanish heritage, but not close enough where
you
I can
get the passport,
you know, be able to get it. No. Damn it. So close. But I think, again, that it being in the EU specifically is so special. And that's what really broke my heart when I saw Brexit happen in the UK. I'm like, that is just, what are you doing? You know, I mean, certainly, like for retiring, I have a lot of friends that are moving over now in their 40s and their 50s because they're looking at the long game and they're like, well, if I can work or bring in other money from this other situation in a number of these countries and I can retire and have choices here within the whole EU, that's pretty special. It's a pretty good position to be in. So do you find, I mean, I'm sure the expat community, there's got to be a pretty robust one in Madrid as there are in any major city centers. Do you find that you mix with a lot of expats there, or is it mainly like other Spaniards?
For me, it's Spanish people and young Spanish people. I have a few expat friends, but they're also younger people. So most of my friends are Spanish and a lot of them speak English because they need it and they want to practice English. So the language thing is not so difficult.
Are you still doing any of the language teaching there?
I do those immersions all the time. I've met so many interesting people through those and it's a free vacation, you know, and especially during the pandemic and the lockdown, there were 3 months we couldn't even go out of our apartments. And then if your neighborhood was a hotspot, you couldn't leave a 6-block area. And so these English immersions were still going on. People were still learning English. So you could get traveling papers if you tested negative and go up to the mountain for a week. So I was like, I'll do it.
I mean, you've kind of sold me on that. It's funny because, I mean, I obviously speak English. I speak some French, which is getting progressively worse, and I really want to work on my Spanish. But every time I'm in any Spanish-speaking country, a lot of times people just want to speak English with me because they want to practice. Meanwhile, their English is, like, perfect, and they speak 3 other languages, and I feel like an idiot barely having, you know, 1.5.
A lot of my friends here speak French as well as their native Spanish, as well as English really quite well, especially the, like, the 30 and under. They're really getting it in the schools, which people 40 or even 35 and above, they still are learning. So,
that's the education factor too. I love it. I also found that, you know, as the world gets smaller through technology and everything else, I mean, everywhere I go, there's the commonalities of pop culture and love of movies and music. And it's interesting to see. And I always like, being both American and Canadian, I always welcome questions too, because I think people generally are like, they love both America and Canada, but they're also enormously confused by America and be like, what the hell is going on? So I think I really enjoy this conversation because I'm like, I'll just try to tell you how the system is set up, if that gives any context. And I actually found that helped a lot of people when I explained how elections worked and stuff in our crazy system, because it's not something that's widely known. And I think when people know that, they're
and
like,
it's
oh
different
my God.
In Europe. I mean, in Europe, there's more than 2 parties and that, you know, everywhere. And that
that's
makes
right.
a difference, a big difference.
Well, in Spain, too, very interesting because whenever I go somewhere, even if I've been a bunch before, I always do a deep dive of history before I go just to brush up. And really trying to familiarize myself with the autonomous regions in Spain. And that's a whole other situation, too, politically. Certainly when I was in Barcelona, that's always a big part of the discussion, being talking about Catalonia and everything else. And so I always tell people to make sure that they know what's up before like going to certain cities and making, you know, statements where they might not know. But if you look at the news in Spain, there's quite a lot of discussion around, you know, some rifts in those areas. But that's same to be said with
well, and also
really.
Just culturally, like in Spain, not all Spaniards love flamenco. You know, it's from the south. And bullfighting is really controversial. I would say don't even bring it up unless you know the position of the people you're with. Because it can really be a hot discussion.
Because I see it's been banned in a lot of parts of the country, and then obviously not in others.
But it was banned, and then it was overturned in the courts. It really can't be banned. But
interesting.
In some places, it's just not popular because, like the Canaries and in Catalonia, they just don't like it. But other places, you know, it is very popular.
And for you, I mean, do you find at this point, because you've been, how many years have you lived there now?
Five.
So have you traveled like predominantly, well, you've probably been all over Spain at this point. Are there regions that you haven't been that you would like to see yet, or areas that surprised you the most?
Well, the one area I haven't been to yet is Galicia, which is that little piece over Portugal. And that whole northern coast along the Bay of Biscay is quite rainy and cold. It's like England. So I have done San Sebastian, Bilbao, Asturias. I have not done Galicia yet. So that's the main one that's outstanding.
You know, it's really funny that you say that. I'm going to just say this is a little pop culture movie reference. I had a colleague that was actually from there. And when she told me, I was like, where are you talking? I don't know where you're talking about. And she said, there's like a movie or miniseries or something, a Spanish miniseries. She's like, it used to be like the cocaine coast. Like a lot of drugs used to come in there in the 80s, like Miami. I was like, what? So I went online and there's something on Netflix about it. And that was the first I'd heard about it. And then she told me about the weather, lots of like, I mean, there's seafood everywhere, but I think there's like a big
fish. Yeah, it's really, really good up there. And the food is really, it's known for the gastronomy along that area. But, an interesting thing about Spain is that the people from that northern coast and the people from the southern coast are very, very different. So the southern part is the flamenco, the bullfighting, the gitanos, that whole, you know, very colorful, hot, passionate culture. And the people on the north, the Basque people and the Gallego people, are really hardworking. They're very serious. They're just like completely different. And they don't get the southern people at all. You know, so it's, you know, and the accent is very different. In the Spanish, it sounds very different in those two areas.
Yeah, that's true. For somebody who doesn't speak Spanish, I've been around certainly the Basque speakers, and then being down south, it's very different. I mean, I would say the same in France too, where it's one's much harsher. But I think that's what's so fascinating about it. And again, it's like understanding how the country came together. Certainly, all the waves of people that had come into the country. Certainly, lots of stamps from North African history as well.
Well, the Arab
down
it was,
south from
you know people say the Moorish influence. It was the capital of the Arab Empire for 800 years. It's a lot more than influence.
It's true, but I think people, I mean, obviously not Spaniards, but again, I'm talking North Americans. It doesn't come to mind because they're forgetting the longevity around that culture and how people were moving or where they were invading, as it were. And so that's fascinating. And I sometimes forget until being in certain places in the South, especially, you're just overwhelmed by architecture or certain artistic touches that were clearly stemmed from that period.
Food in the South, a lot of it is Arab influenced food.
Oh, speaking of food, I heard somebody I know in Barcelona was talking about paella and how it's like not really, it's really influenced by a lot of like the similar Persian dish, which would make sense. They came over a long time ago, but how they're all very like, they don't think a lot of people do it well. And he was like, the people in Valencia do the best paella. Well,
and they're
like,
very chauvinistic about their paella. Of course, if you're in Valencia, their paella is the only true paella. Everything else is just rice with things in it. You know, so there's and there's the true paella of Valencia only has chicken,
yep.
green beans, and what we call butter beans. It could have yeah. snails. It could have rabbit, but no fish. No sausage.
No, that's what I heard. Yeah, sausage. People were really, really upset about that. I don't remember that being a thing until I was part of that conversation, and I was like, whoa, this is really heated, like, but it's fascinating.
It's like the paella, the bullfighting.
Well, and I think, too, you know, with tapas, we have all these, like, Spanish tapas bars. I'm putting air quotes here. Back in the States that are delicious, but tapas are really bar food where you have, like, snacks with your drinks, really, as you're moving around in your evening, which I love. It makes sense if you need to be sustained as you're eating at 9, 10, 11 o'clock.
Well, and the thing is that in Spain, the like you said, it's a very nocturnal. It's shifted to the night because of the heat, right? So
yep.
they get up late, they stay up late, they get up late in the morning. And so then lunch is 2 to 4, and lunch is the main meal of the day. This is 3 courses with wine. After that, you're sleepy. So
siesta.
The siesta. Dinner is not yep. until 9 earliest, and often it's not dinner, it's just wine and tapas.
Snacks, yeah. I mean, I'm not opposed to that. I could adjust. Did you find that adjustment okay when you moved there?
I've always not been a morning person. So for me, it was like my perfect life. That was another factor. Look. I was like, these people don't know how to live. You don't have to get up early in the morning. You can stay up late, just drink wine.
But I think what you did, I mean, for me, again, and I'm surrounded by so many amazing women in my life and a lot of people that are single career women that travel a lot as well. And I think, and I include myself in that category, and I'm always looking again at what makes the most sense now and going into the future. And so, again, going back to your story, a lot of it resonated with me. But being in Spain for so many reasons, just like you said, checks the boxes for people that have, you know, the kind of loves of that kind of lifestyle, and the country's beautiful. And like you said, it's very diverse depending on what coast, and there's so many different things there. I think it's becoming more and more and more international. Not that it already wasn't, but like you said, the businesses that are coming into Madrid, like Barcelona is already full of international students, but it felt like I heard so many different languages there this time. It felt very different. So I'm very excited for what the future would bring into that. So aside from teaching still, which I'm going to be looking into some of those things you were talking about right after. And I actually do want to come to Madrid for an intensive, like my friend did like a 2-week Spanish immersive course. I was like very tempted by that. But you are also, or you're writing now, or you have written before, and you've transitioned into more writing. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I was a journalism major in college, way, way back, a long time ago. And then I worked as a journalist, fashion journalist for a while, and a copywriter. And then I went in more into the film business. And then when I left the film business, I went back to working as a freelance journalist. And I've written 2 memoirs that have been published about my sort of spiritual adventures. This is my first one, called Medicine Dance. I say it's like Eat, Pray, Love without food or water. I studied with a Native American medicine man, and that was part of what got me to Santa Fe and New Mexico. He was from that area. And so it was, I had had a cancer scare, and in that time when I was getting second mammograms and all that, someone said, why don't you go to this Native American medicine man who's in town for a healing? And I did, and then the next day I went for the sonogram, and they're like, why are you even here? There's nothing there. So I was really interested. So I got quite deeply into studying with him in the Native American healing traditions around the Pueblo culture of New Mexico. And yeah. So my first book, Medicine Dance, is about that apprenticeship and process of learning from him. Kind of overlapping
That's so amazing.
With that, I met a West African shaman in Los Angeles from the Yoruba culture of what's now Nigeria, and I studied with him as well. And so the second book is about that. It's I ended up having a romance with him that was quite stormy, and
I'm intrigued.
From polygamous traditions, and mm-hmm. you know, so And then the mythology of the Europa people is very interesting and complex. I would say in some ways similar to Jungian psychology and working with archetypes. And both the Native American and the West African work with drumming, dancing, and singing as the healing modalities. Because we know from quantum physics, we're only made up of atoms moving. We're just energy. We're just vibration. So if our vibration falls out of harmony, we go into dis-ease. So these ancient cultures knew that, and they had sacred vibrations that they used to bring you back into vibrational harmony. So the first book, Medicine Dance, the second book is called Honey in the River, because the river is a goddess named Oshun, and she's the goddess of love and eroticism. And one of her favorite offerings is honey. So when you're trying to heal your love life, you go put honey in the river. So,
listen, I'm already intrigued. You've already sold me on two books. I think also I see a lot of the younger generation, certainly online, they're really very invested as well in a lot of spiritual practice and understanding these things. And just like you said, they're very deep. I mean, all Native American culture, period. That's all part of the nature healing and talking about spirituality and how everything is connected, mm-hmm. Which feeds right into energy and you're saying vibration. And if people don't get that yet and they're like, woo woo, it's really not. Like, this is just a matter of science. And it's in any, you can hear a whole bunch of people speak on it, whether you prefer a scientist or, you know, a medicine man. So it is something that's really fascinating. And the more you understand it, I think it's very eye opening. But I digress. Those are two books, but I think you're working on a third.
Well, the third one I'm working on is a memoir of the Hollywood years. So,
yes, okay.
It's called Off Camera. It's the working title, at least. And it's just like my adventures and interactions with the famous actors and directors and all the things that happened in that. So.
See, it's taking every ounce of my being not to ask you a million questions about that, because I'm film obsessed. I have a number of friends that work in film. I was a producer for about 5 years. It's kind of weird that I don't work in that anymore because I really am obsessed with it. But I mean, just again, going back to the time frame that you were working there, and I can only imagine what you were up against and just the wild things you would have seen, although a lot of that will be in the book, so I don't even have to give too much away. unless you want to share a little teaser or any antidote of like, did you have a favorite film that you'd worked on, or was there like a standout?
Well, for me, the one that I learned the most from, and it was really a kind of revolutionary experience, was Clint Eastwood directing on a film called Bird about jazz, about the life of Charlie Parker.
So, oh, wow.
So that was, he was really a master director, and for me, far and above everybody else. And it was a very interesting experience.
What an experience. And of course, now you being in Spain, which, I mean, we can talk about film in Spain all day long, just pumping out incredible film. And we can go into all the Almodovar movies, which every time I see one, I'm blown away again and again and again. But cinema is so strong in Spain. And like we said, Netflix, I'm glad that you brought that up, had decided to open a studio in Madrid, just because really giving film and entities direct to consumer, they need to create more international content, but also like buy a lot of content that exists as well.
And then the other European filmmakers are making films for Netflix, and the British and all that are coming to Madrid. I mean, Wes Anderson was shooting here just recently, and you know, so because the crews are quite good and quite professional. The facilities are here, and I think it's a bargain price compared to other European countries.
Well, yeah, and I was just reading, too, that Antonio Banderas, who I think was born and raised in Malaga, had real estate around the world, and then after his heart attack was like, no, moving back to Spain permanently and moved back to Malaga, and then he has, I think, a theater company.
Right,
there.
And he wants to include a school for young actors and theater professionals, and he's quite devoted to producing musical comedies in Spanish there in Malaga. So that's adding more cultural interest and creativity to Malaga, which is another amazing story that, you know, 20 years ago, guidebooks told you not to go to Malaga because it was so rough. Now it's completely gentrified, and it's wonderful. And, you know, it's an incredible place to retire. So,
yeah, the whole, I mean, I was eyeing a lot of real estate when I was down there recently. I'm not going to lie. Like, I was up the coast a little bit in Estepona, which just like on the coast, but all of it, people listening, I'm just telling you, go online right now and start looking at all the the beauty that is there. And that
is
in Spain.
Is the other amazing thing about Spain that's really great is the infrastructure of Spain. So, you know, I looked again at Mexico, Central, South America a lot. In Spain, you can drink the water out of the tap. The electricity is on 24/7. In Madrid, they pick up the trash every night, every night. People power wash the sidewalks. And the trains and the public transportation, you can get from Madrid to Barcelona on a high-speed train in 2.5 hours. You can get from Madrid to Malaga in 2.5 hours. And they're clean and they're convenient and they're really comfortable. The metro in Madrid, I don't have a car. I don't need a car. I can get anywhere really fast. It's comfortable. It's clean. It's cheap. You know, it's like, that's a huge luxury. And to me, well
it's a huge,
worth
huge luxury.
Paying a little more in taxes.
100%. I mean, it's the walkability factor is huge, huge, huge. And yeah, like you said, public transport, the airports, having been through both like Barcelona and Malaga recently, are super, super updated, like everything in Europe. And people forget like how much different revenue comes in. Like Barcelona, when I was there, the ports were just lined up like crazy with the amount of ships that come into that port. I mean there was the cruise ships, but let's forget about those.
Yeah.
Looking at like all the business, like there's so much business coming into these different ports because Spain's always been so predominantly important given their location. It just bodes well for a very strong future. And so I have definitely been thinking more and more about it, which is why when I heard your story, I'm like, I need to answer immediately. And you worked in film and you were a writer. So, I mean, I want other people to feel inspired to travel on their own or to move and know that there's options out there for people and to not be afraid because don't wait on anything. Don't wait on somebody else. If you want to make a change, you can make it happen. And clearly you did and are loving life in Madrid. And so
it was a really brilliant decision. It's worked out really well. So,
no, I'm very excited for you. And so we'll leave it on this, but when can we expect your memoir, your film memoir? Do you know when it's coming out?
Let's say next year, roughly.
Okay, next year. Well, what I'm going to do is when we have the show notes, I will hyperlink all your books and I'll make a note so people remember that it's coming. But I really appreciate your time today and speaking with me.
My pleasure.